Continuing education is more essential and more strategically valuable than ever. The old model of front-loaded education is no longer viable. Today's learners need relevant and flexible CE to keep pace.
And we have a free resource to help your learning business provide that kind of high-impact learning. The Strategic CE Playbook introduces a practical framework to help you strategically design and deliver continuing education programs that will succeed in today's complex and competitive market.
The playbook focuses on three essential levers: personalization, portfolio thinking, and performance.
To learn more about the three levers and how to use them effectively, get your copy of the Strategic CE Playbook at leadinglearning.com/strategic-CE.
Where do I see learning? And it's meetups, it's podcasts, it's people asking Google or asking AI the answer to things. It's all these sort of roots growing out the side of the plant.
I'm Salisa Steele.
I'm Jeff Cobb, and this is the Leading Learning Podcast. We've reached a point in history where learning and technology are very often a package deal. It's essentially a given that learning products and services will make use of tools and technology to deliver, support, or deepen learning. Jeff Stead has dedicated his career to building learning tools that sit in what he calls the messy middle between the power of new technologies and real human learning needs. He's currently chief product officer at a LearnTech business in the UK called MyTutor, and he's co-author of Engines of Engagement, a curious book about generative AI. In this episode, number 411, Salisa and Jeff talk about the changes he's seen over the course of his long career in how technology supports learning. The discussion encompasses mobile learning, the seismic shift that is generative AI, just-in-time learning, his optimistic view of the future of learning, the potency of low ego and high curiosity in collaborations, how he thinks about innovation, and common barriers to and accelerators of innovation. Jeff is both thoughtful and experienced, as you'll hear in his conversation with Salisa, which took place in late April 2024.
Could you say just a little bit more for listeners about kind of the types of work that you tend to do?
I invent and build learning products is probably the simplest, cleanest way to say that. But actually, my role as a CPO is more senior. So in reality, what I tend to do is build the teams and set up the culture and inspire them and set the direction. And it's actually people who are way more up to date with tools and tech in my team who do the building and the making. I've dived into language learning. I was leading a language app called Babbel in Berlin for a while. I've done a lot of inside company L&D type tech build training. I've worked in language assessment, online tutoring at the moment. I've mostly moved between larger startups, sometimes called scale-ups, and big organizations, and sort of moved between those, just trying to understand different aspects of learning and tech and human behavior, trying to find smarter ways to use emerging tech to deliver better learning impact. And kind of along the way, hopping between those two different types of organization, I've built a bit of a specialism in helping businesses recapture their innovation spirit or help them pivot in times of difficulty. And startups tend to go through this difficulty as they scale up and it doesn't scale anymore, or large organizations who've got successful at one thing really struggle with waves of change and how you adapt to that. And along this journey, always with the lens of learning and technology, I've quite often ended up running innovation labs or coaching leaders on how to bring in innovation into a team or reset the culture a bit. So I've accidentally built a specialism in that innovation area, but actually it's probably learning tech is where my heart is.
I definitely want to talk more about innovation. So I'm going to sort of bookmark that to come back to. You do bring deep experience as a technologist. And so I'm curious to know, in your time using and studying and developing technology, what key changes have you seen and what trends are you seeing in how technology is supporting or might support learning?
Lovely, lovely question. The thing with the tech is quite often there's a hype about the new, like what's coming next. AI or whether it's VR or goggles or whatever's coming. And actually, sometimes the real lessons I learn have been true through my whole career. It's not always the tech that's the real lesson. I was quite, in hindsight, quite lucky where I started. I started with a very early in the learning technology era, sort of pre-web, very beginnings of web. And I focused with adult learners who had low skill learners in the UK, literacy, numeracy, help finding a job, people who the mainstream had let down. They weren't at university, they weren't at college, they were probably sometimes not employed, they might have dropped out of school. And this, in hindsight, was the perfect place for me because I was really got inspired about using tech for impact, using the learning moment to make it change. So I was left obsessing about not what you delivered, but what happened to the users who used the thing that you made. So it's not about the content, it's about the new skills that you're helping them develop or what they do next with that skill. Did they get a job? Did their confidence improve? Were they able to read at an appropriate level? And so the idea that technology is used kind of in conversation with learning, that they're both equal partners and they jostle for a space rather than it just being a broadcast mechanism. And I think that's probably true still of how I think about tech today, the latest wave, obviously generative AI, that I'm still thinking of how it's a conversation and how you build a bridge between your needs as a human and the power of the tech. Obviously, these are not my original ideas, right? I'm standing on the shoulders of giants like Seymour Papert or Paulo Freire, all these sort of great thinkers who were doing this even before I started. But I guess these ideas probably stay quite true. And then if you fast forward, I've been several sort of amazing tech wild rides. I mean, the web, we take it for granted now. It was phenomenal when it first came out that you could publish something and everybody in the world could read it. And there was a sort of openness of platforms that you could use open source content. The content was open sourcing, like Wikipedia, and availability of information was quite an amazing moment. And media streaming, how cheap it is for us right now to create a podcast, to record it, to distribute it, to be heard around the world, this sort of standardization that allows that. It was sort of inconceivable 20 years ago, and it's all part of the wave around us. So I guess all of these things they're huge in hindsight, even though you maybe didn't appreciate it as they were coming along. Mobile was big for me. I was a very early adopter in apps for learning, pre-smartphone, pre-iPhone, where there was sort of handheld devices that used Wi-Fi only. And we were building very, very early apps for that. And again, that was sort of learning outside the mainstream, adult learning. Well, our first app was driving theory tests, but we did quite a few apps that were around kind of performance support for companies. So I rolled out multiple apps in the UK and across Europe around performance support type of things in the very, very early stage. And that got me to the US. Myself and some of my team were headhunted by a big Californian tech firm called Qualcomm and brought over to do the same thing sort of internally inside their organization to try and think about cutting edge of mobile and learning or performance improvement apps and what those might look like. And so we ended up building an entire employee app store and filled with apps that we'd made, that other people that we could convince to make them in the company made, that we, if we could bully suppliers to create mobile versions of the websites that we were licensing from them, that would go into the app store. And it was great fun because it was a total break with the idea that L&D is about courses and structures and predefined things. It was the opposite. It was saying, just-in-time information can be a wide range of use cases, but you need it on your phone immediately, even if there's security concerns, even if we'll find ways of bridging those, we'll find ways of understanding the security concerns and putting in place ways that was allowed. And so we had 40 apps or so available for any employees in the company, and they were a wide range. Some were quite serious, like literally look up information about current projects across the organization that were quite difficult to find on the internal websites because they were very siloed, but we'd sort of got the data approved. Some were kind of nice karma. So Qualcomm was making quite early augmented reality sort of features on their chips, which weren't really in mainstream phones yet. And we were building playful augmented reality apps, just that employees felt cool about themselves. We made like cheesy photo booths that you could get a picture of yourself taken together with one of the founders or one of the C-levels in the company, even though you were in Asia somewhere in one of the Qualcomm offices and the founder was based in California, you could have a picture standing next to them. So sort of silly things like this. Celebratory things. We, together with a bunch of artists, made an augmented reality artwork that was a Guinness World Record largest one, right the way down the side of an enormous building, done in secret over the weekend. We had it pre-made and secretly went on Sunday and kind of revealed it. So when people arrived at work on Monday, there was this enormous artwork that you could walk down with your phone and bits would pop out. It was telling bits of the history of the company and how they'd got there and pieces of the sort of company history. Sorry, I'm getting a bit excited. But so I guess the main thing is we were thinking about learning as an ecosystem of sources of information, which was great fun. So that was a sort of my mobile era, I guess. And then after that, I ended up going to, I got quite intrigued by the kind of consumerization of learning, the fact that we were creating stuff that it was useless unless somebody wanted to install it on their phone. It was optional. They didn't have to. And if they did install it, it was partly useless unless they came back more often. And so we got quite interested in how people like Duolingo, some of the consumer businesses, work at helping you come back and return and stick with learning and what those levers feel like. And so we did quite a bit of work on that at Qualcomm. But then I ended up joining a big language app business called Babbel in Berlin, in Germany. They are exactly like that, sort of similar to Duolingo. They have an app which, if you want to learn a language, you pay a monthly amount. It's sort of mass consumerizing learning. But you want to do it. That's why you start. But people drop off quite fast. And we really wanted to understand how you use the levers of mobile engagement, nudging, to help people come back and study a bit longer or stick with it for longer so that actually they do learn the language. It's not just a dream that died out. They kind of stick with it till it really works. Yeah, so there's sort of behavioral nudges, gamification kind of levers. And what was very cool there was we had a massive user base, like millions of people logging in, learning different languages. And so we also got very good at understanding the data that underpins what's going on and trying to get a sense of learning patterns, what works. So at that stage, I guess there I was very excited about the whole user behavioral economics, what helps you stick with learning, what those levers are. I'm still surprised that this isn't more mainstream in learning, in people working on training and learning tools, because they're really powerful levers, you know, the different nudging, behavior, sort of setting healthy habits, levers. You really can help people achieve their learning aim more easily if you just give them these little nudges. While I was there, we also got very big on thinking about learning as an ecosystem. So I joined Babbel, they had a single app and were selling a single app. And by the time I left, we had podcasts and games and you had live lessons and we were selling to enterprise as well as direct to consumer. And we managed to change the way we thought about what we did as a business so that it was about lots of channels and helping people achieve their aim via lots of channels rather than it being about selling an app. And I think that was really nice sort of holistic framing. And then one more chapter, I guess. I'm kind of telling you all my life history here. So I'm now in my tutor, which is an online sort of online tutoring platform, and really trying to understand. And until this point, I've mostly been creating the digital parts of the learning. It's a standalone digital learning experience, mostly one person. But we know that tutors really help, or having a mentor can really help. Having a human in the loop really helps. What I'm doing at the moment is trying to understand that intersection between human and tech and a live taught class with tech around the side and what that might look like, which leads me to the generative AI sort of wave of hype that's current at the moment. And without a doubt, I think that's the most seismic thing I've seen in quite a long time. I think we don't quite understand what it's going to do yet, but all the touch points I'm seeing, it's doing massive things, or it's got the potential to do massive things. It's a significant performance enhancer in the workplace. There's some great studies. If you're unaware of it, there's Ethan Mollick has one around the jagged frontier, where he sort of gave a whole lot of BCG consultants AI to support their work and other ones not AI, and tried to understand the differences, and very strong correlation with the ones who are using AI doing better work and faster, kind of like 25% faster, 40% better quality. But also interesting, a leveler, that the people who were at the lower performers got a more of a boost. They were like 43% of a boost, whereas the more senior ones got a smaller boost, a sort of 17% of a boost. So it's kind of interesting. It's a fascinating tool in helping people perform better at work and trying to think that through. So that was a rather meandering wander, but I just thought it would be quite a nice way to look at some of the changes in tech and tie that up with stuff that I'd learned as I went through.
No, yeah, thank you very much. And it's very interesting to sort of hear about those different chapters in your own experience, which technologies were sort of maybe top of mind in each of those chapters and how they fit together. I hear in all that you were sharing that a real focus on, I guess, what I might put under the umbrella of impact, right? Like, are you actually really helping the learners to do something? Are you providing those nudges that are going to get them to come back and continue to engage? And that technology is a potential partner in doing that and supporting that. And so that real focus on the impact rather than the technology in and of itself or the quote course in and of itself, and really thinking more broadly about how do you support humans in learning and in applying what they're learning, right?
At Tagoras, we partner with professional and trade associations, continuing education units, training firms, and other learning businesses to help them understand market realities and potential, to connect better with existing customers and find new ones, and to make smart investment decisions around product development and portfolio management. Drawing on our expertise in lifelong learning, market assessment, and strategy formulation, we can help you achieve greater reach, revenue, and impact. Learn more at tagoras.com/more.
When you think about the future of learning, what's your view? What's your perspective on the future of learning?
You might guess it from my general enthusiastic nature, but I'm a real optimist about learning, the power of learning, our needs as humans to keep learning and to keep discovering. What's the future of learning? It will find a way. Right? We have to adapt. You find a way of adapting. You have to learn new things. You find a way of learning new things. The question is, it sort of with or without official endorsement? Is it in traditional channels or is it maybe not in those traditional channels at all? And I think that's maybe the more interesting area. If you think about the world we're in at the moment, what's happening in people's regular lives, environments, in your organizations, companies struggling revenue-wise or trying to adapt at the moment, there's so many challenges around us, and lots of them have learning as a possible solution, right? Help your team improve better, help your business pivot and go in a different direction, help me succeed as a professional by dealing with some gaps in my skills. So learning is a fairly key demand. And at the same time, there's amazing tooling available right now, just sort of globally, the tech, AI stuff. I can access a human trainer, a mentor. They can be sitting in India, but if they're an expert in my area and I can connect, they can coach me. There's sort of incredible tooling around which brings a level of global accessibility to learning too. So actually, it's kind of a positive story. There's demand. There's lots of ways of creating reach. I mean, great. So what are the things? What are the kinds of things that I think are coming or I think are the most powerful? I guess mentoring generally, sort of AI, human, hybrid, some sort of use of ways of connecting me to somebody who cares about me and wants my skills to get better. Simulations, there's, again, Gen AI does this well, but there's other tooling that does it quite well as well, 360 video, or there's tools that help you simulate work or experiences and practice some skills and build some sort of stronger skills in a context, I think really powerful. Just broadly performance support, being able to, on my phone, at a moment, talk, write, take a picture, get some feedback on that thing, that task I'm trying to do right now. Sort of, again, you mentioned it before, you've called it out, but a focus on the outcomes or the sort of the impact that you're trying at that moment. A lot of the innovation happens around the edges. So I was reflecting, when you asked that, I was reflecting on my own career and where do I see learning? And it's meetups, it's podcasts, it's people asking Google or asking AI the answer to things. It's all these sort of roots growing out the side of the plant. It's things coming around, innovation around the edges. So I think that's often where you see the new tools or the new approaches. You see them sort of approaching from the side. And I guess I have to talk a bit more about generative AI if you're thinking about the future, right? Because it really is something quite unique and quite special. And I think one of the opportunities is sort of weirdly the smartest people who are building it, the real language experts or AI experts, they don't actually know why it's doing exactly what it's doing. And they're not experts at how you apply it. So they're kind of experts at the language model, but kind of not at how it's used. And so there's this gap between the inventors and possible users, and it's evolving very fast. And that space in the middle is potentially a super exciting place for anybody in the learning, training kind of area to have a look, because there's a gap there. There's a lot of uncertainty and people aren't quite sure how to use it and nervousness. And so few people are stepping into the gap that even just spending a couple of days immersing yourself in it will probably make you an expert in your area. So it feels to me that gap in the middle is an amazing space to try and get involved and understand the power that's coming and your particular use case or subject specialist area and try to understand what that looks like. Conversely, if you don't do that, actually any of your competitors anywhere in the world can, because most of these tools are globally available. So it's there at the moment and there's not enough people stepping in, but I don't think that it will stay as an open space forever. I'm intrigued by the fact that it's unusual in being a super powerful technology that actually people don't really know why and how it does the things it does and how best to apply it. And there's lots of bad examples of people tried to apply it, it didn't quite work. And there's some really powerful examples, but it's a very emerging area. So that gap in the middle feels like an exciting place to try and learn a bit more and understand.
Yeah, I really appreciate that you call out that gap. And I personally hadn't really thought of generative AI as kind of, but I mean, it makes sense though, when I reflect, right? Like it's this very powerful tool, but we're not exactly sure what it's a tool for or sort of how to best use that tool. And so digging into that, yes, does seem like an area of a lot of opportunity and excitement potentially. So you are a co-author along with Seychatz and Julian Stad, and we've been lucky enough to have both of them on the podcast in the past, but the three of you co-wrote Engines of Engagement, a curious book about generative AI. And the most recent episode where we had Julian on, we really sort of focused on that book and some of the key concepts. So to go in a little bit of a different direction with you, I would just be curious to know, what was it like to write a book with two other people? You know, what did you learn from that experience and that collaboration process?
In reflecting back, I loved it. It was a really interesting experience helping me frame my own thinking. I'm not a writer. It's the first book I've written. I begrudgingly have written a couple of papers under great duress at various stages in my life, but I really mostly try and avoid it. I'm more comfortable speaking and drawing and enthusing. So writing was a new experience for me, and co-writing with some other people was a new experience for me. And I really loved it. I think we all had fairly low egos and high curiosity, and we all had different strengths and specialisms. And that kind of worked really well because we were accountability partners to each other. We would have a fixed phone call every week, the same time for an hour and a half. And we would talk about what we'd done, the writing that we'd done in the previous week. Sometimes we hadn't, but we had the call anyway, and we would critique each other's work and plan for the next week. And I think that level of accountability really helped me because we were all doing it alongside a day job. And we kind of, our energy balanced each other out, because sometimes I would be burning with a particular message I wanted and I could go and churn ahead and write a few chapters, and Julian was distracted. And then 2 weeks later, Julian would go through mine and change it. And so by the end, it was quite hard to distinguish who wrote what. It's sort of, the ideas are quite woven together. So yeah, I guess that was a sort of the low ego, high curiosity, mutual respect thing worked well. I have a very solid underpinning on the tech side and the practical realities of building tools and what Gen AI, what you might do and say. I had a very sort of fiercely academic perspective. She's really a learning scientist with sort of strong background in evidence research and proof, being able to prove things. And Julian is a sort of very free-ranging thinker about organizational culture and some of the more philosophical aspects of change. And so we really had different specialisms, but we had this sweet spot in the middle, trying to figure out how we were thinking about generative AI, how we thought it might impact organizations, how it impacts learning. And then as time passed, we developed a shared voice. It started off, you could initially see who'd written which bit, but then we sort of we built a shared voice and also a kind of confidence. One of us would write something a bit wacky or put a bit of a poem in the middle of the text just because it felt like it needed a mix. And then because nobody else took it out, we'd get confidence. And then the next person would do something else a little bit unconventional. And I think that partly makes me quite proud when I look back at it. It was interesting, this art and some sort of poems and fairly wide-ranging thoughts. And I think we only got there because we encouraged each other and were kind of impressed by each other's quirks. I read one review which said something like, it felt like they were sitting around a fire with a cold beer talking about AI with a bunch of interesting people who knew different bits about it. And that was what they wanted to help frame their thinking. And I really liked that idea, that actually this is a book version of sitting around a fire with some mates, having a cold beer and chatting about the world and sort of trying to make sense of it. That was our journey. I mean, I'd of course love it if your audience gave us any feedback. We're still slightly tentative and new in this book writing business. And so kind of anxiously watched to see who's posted reviews where. So if people are interested, we're making a free one available to download. And we'd love to just have feedback. Just tell us if you found it helpful.
Well, hearing what you highlighted, the low ego and the high curiosity and how that made for a successful collaboration. I mean, it just struck me that the same sort of formula, low ego, high curiosity, makes for a really good learning engagement, right? If you approach any subject with those two things, it seems like you're going to be better off than if you came in with high ego or, you know, low curiosity. Innovation is also a big area of focus and interest for you. And as I understand it, particularly how to build an innovation culture, perhaps within a larger, less innovative structure or business. But I thought as we begin to talk about innovation, it might just be interesting here at the beginning to ask you, how do you define or describe innovation?
I guess I probably think about it in terms of stepping outside the perceived constraints of the moment. So maybe finding a new or unexpected way of solving a business challenge or a learning challenge, or maybe stepping out of the more comfortable incremental methods of improvement that a business has got and trying to find new ideas or new approaches or ways of taking bolder steps forward. Sometimes it's about a new product or sometimes it's about a particular business challenge. But I mentor companies sometimes in this area, and quite often they have a fairly clear business need, like we're struggling with product market fit of this thing we've built, or we work too slow, or we want to build this new product. So there's a fairly clear problem statement, but with totally unreasonable constraints, they expect you will also be able to solve, and everybody's got 10 other things they think you'll solve at the same time, how quickly, costs, using these people, using this process, and they've got themselves stuck in a place where they kind of know what they want solving, but they've added all these constraints that make it impossible. So when I think about innovation, it's often about trying to help people step away from the constraints that are holding them back to enable them to take a slightly bolder step forward. I end up stripping back a lot of those constraints to try and find a smaller subset of real success criteria. You know, if we could fix this, is this innovation? So it tends to evolve a little bit in conversation. But yeah, I think it's about stepping outside the comfortable path for moving slowly forward so that you can move faster forward.
What's your take on the relationship between innovation and culture at an organization or within a group? I mean, is there a certain sort of cultural requirement for innovation to work?
Quick answer, definitely. A slightly longer answer, I don't really like the narrative that you get the kind of creative, crazy people who do the innovation and then you get everybody else who does the day job. And I think that is a narrative that evolves, and you get some amazing design agencies or agencies who will come and embed for a while and spend some time with you and create some innovation thing and then leave and it sort of withers and dies. So I don't like that narrative particularly, that you get the innovators and non-innovators. But there is some truth to how an organization needs to think about innovation, because normally there's loads of cultural barriers that stop innovation happening. And then the main barrier is kind of lots of tiny little things. It's how you manage procurement. It's how the budget cycle works. It's which IT team you're allowed to use. It's the legal thing about which new platform you can test out. It's the other guidance about whether you are in the office or not in the office. It's a bunch of tiny things. And when you add all those up, you end up sucking the air out of the sort of innovation energy. And it's not a bad thing, because when a business is specializing, you've invented this thing, you're making it, that's your business. You want to specialize, and the act of specializing is sort of taking away some of the rogue elements and just getting more and more optimized. But it's exactly that skill set that gets you more optimized, that sort of that gets you there, is the skill set that will stop you doing the innovation. They really are just two different things. And so culturally, can you have a culture that's both of those? With huge difficulty. As an organization, can you grow both of those cultures in different bits? You can. You need to be careful not to upset everybody and make people feel jealous, but it is possible to do that. So I think culturally, you really have to recognize that there are these two zones. There's the sort of the skill set that got you where you are today. And if you really want to bring an innovative energy in, it's the skill set that will take you to that next step. And they're quite different. And probably very few of the leaders of this group can do that. And very few of the systems and processes that you've built around this can do that. You have to find a way of kind of separating those two.
That's very interesting, because I think now maybe I'm better understanding this idea that you tend to focus on innovation within kind of a larger organizational context, maybe because of what I heard in your response there, that just this idea of, I mean, the overall organization may be very focused on, yeah, that specialized skill set that sort of got them where they are. And then for others to be able to sort of forget that and think about other possibilities outside those boundaries, it does almost potentially need to be another group. That's very interesting. And I hadn't quite thought of it. Is that a fair assessment of what you're saying?
I think that's very fair. And there's also lots of examples of organizations trying that and failing. Sometimes people set up a vanity lab where it's a group of crazy people inventing nice things that the CEO likes to show people to. But there's actually no path to take what's invented there and move it over into the main business. And so there's lots of examples, either where things look fun and new stuff is coming out of them, but it doesn't really help the business innovate. So I think there's some guidelines you can put in place to increase the odds that some of the innovative ideas will transition into the main business. But you do need to quite fiercely guard and protect that team and allow them to innovate. And at the same time, try and find paths that help those innovations benefit the bigger business. There's several different ways to approach that. But yeah, it is a challenge.
So now I feel like I have multiple follow-on questions to that. I mean, one is you began to talk about some barriers. Perhaps there are others you want to highlight. If you do, please do. But then you just talked about there's some ways to sort of hopefully set it up for success so that whichever group is thinking about innovation gets to make some progress, really gets to do that. So I would love to hear if you have some suggestions or ideas for listeners to consider around how to make innovation efforts within their organization successful.
Gladly. I guess the one thing is you really do need to protect the runway or the space for the team to be able to fail and experiment and try again and have the confidence to keep going. And so as part of that, you do need to somehow negotiate enough budget or time, elapsed time runway, or find a ways of helping the wider org celebrate some of the lessons learned as you go. What you don't want is that 6 months in, suddenly the rules change and people start coming in and requiring different things. And so I found one of the things, that there's a lovely term called being a chaos pilot, which was a Google term when they were talking about innovation. They thought, if you really want this to work, if you're leading this team, you need to be a bit of a chaos pilot. You need to kind of embrace chaos inside your innovation team, but also be able to translate it into a language that works better in the wider business to maintain that kind of support or the momentum. And part of that, I find, is about being a bit scary. So you do need to remind the business why this is really critical, why you really do need this innovation to work, why it's a long-term view. But also being a bit reassuring that you help paint a picture of the future and tell a story about the lessons that are being learned, so that you're bringing the wider businesses along with you. You're not just going into this little lab and having fun and everybody else looks over the wall. You kind of, your job is, as a leader there, is partly to sort of be this chaos pilot and talk to the wider org. You do need to create some kind of runway, budget, time. There's several models for that. Like there's the sort of three horizons model, or maybe 80-20, or some framing where you think in terms of budget or effort or time, how much of what we're doing today is stuff that has to be useful this year? How much has stuff that has to be useful in 5 years? How much is just a crazy bet, but it might really play off in 10 years? And having some kind of framing that you use to communicate the work you're doing is really helpful. Because if you're talking to conservative, cautious finance person, they might be saying, how much do you want to spend on this weird thing? No, we can't give you more than 1% of the budget. But if you talk to them about what percent of the budget do you want to place for bets for the next 5 years? What percent do you want to place for the bets for the next 10 years? All of a sudden, the conversation changes a bit. And yeah, maybe 1% for the crazy bet is actually quite well spent. But for the nearer one, actually probably 5% of what we're earning is worth investing in. And so just having some kind of horizons framing for the types of experiment you're doing and what the odds of success might be is really helpful. And then really protect the culture. Culture is ridiculously important in these teams. You partly do that by bringing in some new people so that you're not overly constrained by the ideas of the existing org. You partly do that just by celebrating culture. Again, Google had these X Lab. I'm not sure how much it's doing at the moment. But if you search online for their Gimbal onboarding guide, Google X Gimbal, they put together this really lovely book, which was a digital 20-page thing that you would get as a new employee. And it would talk to you about, this is what the culture of this team is. This is what matters. And that it stands well to the test of time. I think it's probably 5 years old, 6 years old. But if you read through it, it's a really nice call to action about what matters in culture, what matters in innovation. Yeah, so that's just a nice thing to have a look at.
Selfishly, one of the other questions that I had hearing you talk about innovation is, I'm part of a very small organization. And so when you talk about, oh, it needs to be kind of a separate group, and it's very hard for the same people who kind of got you where you are and are helping you focus on that to also do innovation. So I guess when you think about smaller organizations, any different tips or ideas for how innovation works within those contexts?
When I think about it for myself, I try and play sometimes or create opportunities to try out new things without a particularly clear end goal. I do keynotes every now and again, and I might try an entirely different tools for presenting with for no real reason, except that I've been using the previous tools for 2 years. And it adds a whole lot of extra stress because I panic and I'm trying to use these tools and I can't master them. But I do that partly because I find that's where I find my innovation, is by trying a constant flow of slightly new things. I find that really useful. I'm not sure if it's called play or panic, one of the other, but I'm trying to create opportunities to use different tools or to be curious about different approaches. So yeah, I'm not sure if that directly answers the question, but that's how I approach it for myself.
Given your technology background, given your interest and expertise in innovation, what do you see as the connection between the two, between technology and maybe especially learning technology, or could be technology broader, and innovation?
I see two different worlds when I think about that. And when I'm reflecting on your podcast audience, I imagine they probably sit across both of these worlds. And in the one world, it's a fairly techno-competent world where it's sort of learning science and experimentation and freedom to try different tools. And here there's a strong connection between sort of learning technology and innovation, because it's what different startups are building and types of learning that people are experimenting with. It's the sort of simulation tools, performance support, just-in-time information, using Gen AI to create things. This is sort of it's an amazing, fertile moment at the moment. And so here, the innovation approach is just have an experimental mindset, kind of what we were just describing. Try some of these tools. You're doing a podcast, try using one of the AI ones that lets you automatically get a transcript and edit the transcript, and it reassembles the video based on the transcript. I mean, there's cool stuff going on at the moment. But the negative thing in this world is there's also a lot of hype, and there's a lot of snake oil salesman telling you that this AI feature is the best thing and it's going to transform. And so you kind of do need to follow the science, and you do need to be kind of experimental and curious and look for evidence as you go. But this is this sort of learning sciencey world. I think there's a strong connection between innovation and the learning tech side. The other world is maybe a more platform constrained view. And so here I was putting myself in the shoes of somebody who's creating learning resources for a big organization in their L&D department, and they have got a very established platform and a very established protocol for the methodologies that you uploaded in. And And there, I think it's much harder because you've got the platform itself might be clever, but there's so many constraints on the kind of format of what you can provide that actually the innovation part has been, is most of it's been pulled away from you. And it's maybe embedded in the platform or maybe it's lost in the noise somewhere. And I think there it's much harder to find the innovation piece. It's still there. And sometimes the way to get to it is actually to go even lower tech. So what you want to do is step outside the constraints. Sometimes simpler tech is actually better. So we're doing a podcast now. Podcasts are amazing. It's just an audio file. It's about as simple tech as you can get. But you can distribute it around tons of channels. People use it in quite creative different ways. The format changes. Whereas if you were building a SCORM structured course around the same topic, you'd be forced into a much more restricted way of working. So I guess those are my two worldviews. There's the sort of learning science one, where I think it's very fertile and innovative. And there's the platform constrained one, which I think a lot of learning professionals do still live in. And there, what I'd encourage people to do is to even go simpler with the tech to try and put the innovation and creativity into how you use the format rather than the tooling itself.
Well, thank you for that. I like that idea of potentially, yeah, simpler tech sometimes can in some ways be more innovative if you have been removing some of the constraints of your current thinking. So thank you. One of the things we always like to ask folks who come on the Leading Learning Podcast is just about their own lifelong learning. So I would be curious to hear from you, Jeff, around your habits or practices or sources that you use to continue to grow yourself.
I guess I mentioned play and panic earlier, and I think maybe that's part of it. I love, if things are getting too stressful at work, we try and arrange a hack day. So people spend a day trying to solve slightly more open-ended challenges and trying to see how to get our heads around that. I found that really helpful in the early days of generative AI to just bring a whole bunch of our team together who weren't experts, but require them to use it in some or other way over the next 2 days and build something. And so that was the hack days. In fact, the book I wrote was a bit like this. I committed to writing it because I felt this was really important and I had a bit of something to say, but I didn't yet feel an expert. In the process of writing it and debating it with Julian and say, I built my confidence and my expertise, or I agreed to do keynotes every now and again for much the same reason. It sort of forces me to panic or to be a bit playful and think about clarifying what I believe about things. I am also fairly curious, and I'm a big believer in multidisciplinarianism, or just having a lot of different disciplines together. And that's part of how I work. We have embraced design thinking and tech and product marketing and different skill sets. We sort of haggle away together to understand how to solve problems. I only work 4 days a week for my tutor, partly because on that fifth day, I mentor different people in different kinds of business because it's sort of stimulating. So I think I try and keep open to different disciplines and listen to them. And I find that I learn from that quite often. I bring learning sort of sideways into my area. And then one other, this is a little bit philosophical. I'm from South Africa. It's where I grew up. I did a TED talk quite some time ago. Part of that was talking about this thing called Ubuntu, which is, it's a sort of philosophical approach to life that it's the opposite of hierarchy. The kind of the idea is, I help everybody else around me because the act of helping them helps me, or that my life is better by lifting everybody else up a little bit. It's a sort of social good kind of mentality. And I think that's woven into how I lead and how I work with colleagues, where you go out of your way to help everybody else perform really well. And by them performing well, actually the whole thing kind of works quite well. It's a fairly sort of, it's a nice philosophy. And I think partly that's why I do learning as a business, because learning is about empowering people and helping them all to do better. And it feeds into how I run teams. And it's often how I learn things, because I learn them from the people around me who feel more open to share what they're learning. And then I kind of learn socially from that. So I guess this Ubuntu, it's worth looking, if you haven't heard of it before, it's worth looking up the word. It's quite nice and sort of reaffirming. But I think that's a thread that followed me through my life and helped me think about how I learn from others.
Jeff Stead is co-author of Engines of Engagement, a curious book about generative AI, and he would love for you to tell him what you think about the book, which is available for free as a digital download or for purchase in hard copy. In the show notes at leadinglearning.com/episode411, You'll find a link to get the book and links to Jeff on X and LinkedIn so you can let him know what you think about it.
At leadinglearning.com/episode411, you'll also find options for subscribing to the podcast. We'd be grateful if you would subscribe if you haven't yet, as those subscriptions give us some insight into the impact of the podcast.
We'd also be grateful if you would rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, especially if you find the Leading Learning Podcast valuable. Those ratings and reviews help us show up when people search for content on leading a learning business.
And please help us grow the Leading Learning community. At leadinglearning.com/episode411, there are links to find us on LinkedIn, X, and Facebook.
Thanks again, and see you next time on the Leading Learning Podcast.